Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When Diplomacy Fails presents.
Hello and welcome to When Diplomacy Fails.
Hey guys, welcome to When Diplomacy Fails. Welcome to When Diplomacy Fails.
Hello and welcome to
Hello
When Diplomacy
Hello and welcome
fails.
To When Diplomacy Fails.
A project 5 years in the making.
The Franco-Prussian War.
The 7 Years' War.
Of the When Diplomacy Fails special on Napoleon.
The Crimean War.
To When Diplomacy Fails special on World War I,
the Dutch Revolt.
To the When Diplomacy Fails special on the 30 Years' War.
The July Crisis Anniversary Project.
The Swedish Deluges.
Britain goes to war.
The 1916.
To the Franco-Dutch War of 1672.
This is When Diplomacy Fails Remastered.
Hello and welcome to When Diplomacy Fails Remastered, a collaboration. The last, final collaboration of this birthday extravaganza we've got going. Sniff, sniff, I know. It's a bit emotional, but it's been a long road. It's been a brilliant road, and I have so appreciated all your guys' support and well wishes and everything else besides. It's been amazing. I mean, as much fun as I had making this and as well I hoped your reactions would be to it. I never imagined I'd get so much love, really. I'm kind of overwhelmed almost. It was amazing. So thank you so much. I'll never forget it. We launch into an exciting new future with When Diplomacy Fails, all thanks to your guys' support during this venture and so many others. A reminder for perhaps one of the final times that I get to throw one of these reminders at you, WDFpodcast.com, guys. Keeping on pushing you towards that direction because, hey, I know that one of these days you'll think to yourself in an epiphany, I can give $2 a month, I can so give $2 a month. And you will, and you won't put on such a wondrous accent as that, but hey, you'll still be giving me money, you'll still be patronizing me, and in return, you'll not only be knowing that you're supporting this podcast, but you'll be getting a good gift yourself, the likes of which depends on how many bajillions of dollars you're willing to give. I'm just kidding. Please check out WDFpodcast.com. Thanks again, guys. I appreciate it so much. Today on the podcast, we have Benjamin Ashwell from Talking History, a podcast on the Italian unification. If you guys know me, you'll know that I've talked to Benjamin Ashwell in the past, so it's not like we're strangers. I mean, I've never had strangers on these kind of collabs before, so that shouldn't be surprising. But yeah, Benjamin Ashwell's a good guy, and stick around to the end to see just how far back we really go, but yeah, I'm really happy I did it, and I think it went really well. We go into loads of different stuff in this talk episode, collaboration episode. Oh, I don't know, the wheels have all come off. The wheels come off pretty quickly in this collaboration episode because I pretty much failed to plug him at the start, and he has to be like, well, I actually do a podcast. It's very funny. Just in case you thought I was infallible, I'm very clearly not, but yeah. The collaborations are coming to an end. This would be the, technically, this is the final one, at least it's the final one on any particular episode, so I really hope you guys enjoy it. Benjamin Ashwell is a great host. We talk about everything from the tragedy of Italy's story to a whole host of other things like Cavour and whether he's as good as Bismarck after all. He's not. No way he is not. Anyway, I hope you guys enjoy it. Let me know what you think through the usual channels. Thanks and enjoy. Okay, folks, welcome to the collaboration episode on the first Italo-Ethiopian War. My guest today is Benjamin Ashwell from the History of the Italian Unification. Say hello, Benjamin.
Hi, how's everyone doing?
Good. We are all fantastic. I think now we're recording this. Sorry to break the fourth wall. I have a habit of doing that. But we're recording this in February. And when people actually get this, it'll be near the tail end of the crazy 5 weeks to run wild fifth birthday of When Diplomacy Fails. So my listeners may be a bit tired of all this content, but we're gonna give it a good run today. So
I think it'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's gonna be great. Gonna be good. A lot of stuff to get through. I mean, the Italo-Ethiopian War. It's one of those. I was never completely happy with the episode, but I think part of that has to do with the fact that I decided it would be a good idea to get it done in a kind of rush job and release it on Christmas Eve. So that might have had something to do with it. But I like to think that I gave it a better run around this time. So this kind of will flesh out that process. So is there anything, I normally start these episodes with a kind of you could say broad question, so to speak. I mean, one of the best ways to kind of approach wars or topics like this that aren't so well known is to basically ask you, Benjamin, when you first learned of or even heard of this war in a basic sense, what kind of struck you about it?
So I came to learn more about, well, so let me back up actually and maybe just give everybody a basic idea what my podcast is about.
Oh, that would have been a better way to start. Yeah, sorry about that.
Well, that's quite all right. No, I say that because it's relevant to my answer. My podcast is Talking History, the Italian Unification, and we cover the history of Italy between 1790 and 1870. Simply put, it's the question of how did Italy go from being a collection of about 11 states, depending on what you want to call Italy and what you want to call a state, in 1790, to a single country in 1870. How did that happen? And what did it mean? What did it mean to become Italian? I started working on that podcast before I even ever heard your original episode all those many years ago about the Italo-Ethiopian War. And what struck me about it was how true to form it was for early Italy. Italy was a country that lurched from crisis to crisis.
Sure.
In its early life, it was a mirror in some ways to Bismarck's Germany.
Well, even the fact that it occurred at the same time, like 1870.
And that's kind of the funny thing. So the man who led Italian unification, there were several big players. The best known one's probably Giuseppe Garibaldi, but the politician who spearheaded unification, the Piedmontese prime minister, Cavour. And in his lifetime, and shortly after, he was regarded by some, especially the British, as the greatest politician who had ever lived. Actually, I was taking notes for my next episode on the topic, and I can, in fact, read a nice quote to that effect.
Yeah.
Give me just a moment.
Sure.
1896, just about the same year as the Italo-Ethiopian War, if not the same. American historian A. Lawrence Lovell wrote, "Victor Emmanuel is the model constitutional king. Cavour, the idea of a cool, far-sighted statesman. Garibaldi, the perfect chieftain in irregular war, dashing but rash and hot-headed. Mazzini, the typical conspirator, ardent and fanatical. All of them full of generosity and devotion." Another guy, actually this one's better, famous British historian Trevelyan called Cavour the most wise and beneficent of all European statesmen of the 19th century, if not of all time. So he was a gigantic deal and, you know, greatest of the 19th century must mean greater than Bismarck in this guy's opinion. Bismarck, of course, everybody knows, but Bismarck is a famous historical figure, whereas Cavour is little known outside of, you know, Italian history.
Sure, yeah. And arguably faced greater challenges because of the resources at Italy's command compared with those of Germany's.
Right, I mean, so Prussia was the biggest fish in the pond, except maybe Austria, and whether they're part of the same pond is a question. But Bismarck had a lot more to work with.
Yeah.
Cavour, in my podcast, I have a hard time making up my mind about Cavour, whether he's a genius or a crazy fool who's lucky. Because some of the stuff some of his plans are insane.
Yeah. I mean,
he'll wake up one morning and go, France is our best friend. We need to, and then by afternoon he's going, well, if we ally with Prussia and Russia and invade Madagascar, we can turn on France. I mean, it's, but the biggest difference, of course, is that, so most of Italy, minus Venice and Rome, was unified in 1860, 61. Cavour died 3 months after the unification, and he was by far the most able politician in all of Italy. Bismarck ran Germany for something like 20 years after its unification.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if that's the big difference.
Yeah, I mean, would you say, I mean, if you were to compare the two figures side by side, do you think that, I mean, say, like, was, actually, probably a better question would be, do you know if the two of them ever interacting with each other? Because I know that Italy, once it was unified, I mean, a key part of Italian history was the Franco-Prussian War, because it was only when French troops were evacuated from Rome in 1870 that...
The problem is Cavour died in mid-1861, so 9 years before the Franco-Prussian War of 1870.
Cool. I mean, Bismarck would only have really have gotten to... I mean, he was ambassador to Russia in 1861, so I suppose, yeah, I mean, there wouldn't really have been much. I just like to think of these... I was talking earlier in a talk episode, collaboration episode, rather, with Travis about the great man of history idea. Do you think that applies to Cavour with what he did for Italy? Or do you think there's a good bit that could still be done? I mean, do you think he's in need of a proper, maybe even a Western biography? Do you think there's more that should be said about him?
Yes, I think there is. Italian unification is tricky, because I imagine also the German unification is tricky, because you look back and it looks inevitable. How could it have ever been any other way? I mean, when I was born, Germany was still two separate countries, East and West, but not for very long. But looking back, I'm thinking, how could it have ever been even two countries? It's always been one country.
Yeah. You
know, even recent history is hard to believe, because you're so used to that everything is the way it's supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, America has 50 states. What are you, insane? I mean, you know, 50 is the right number. With Cavour, what I'll say is this. There were a lot of other people. So Garibaldi, the hero of two worlds, the Gandhi of his era. I don't mean in his philosophy, I mean how well known he was. He was known all over the world, more famous than any of us realize. Mazzini, who was also very famous, the classic conspirator believing in the Italian spirit. There were a lot of important people, but, and I don't want to give Cavour too much credit in that he was not a true believer. He was from Piedmont. That's a country in the northwest of Italy. He was from Piedmont. He was a Piedmontese patriot, not an Italian patriot. The whole thing for him was expanding Piedmont. It's not very hard to cast the Italian unification as the conquest of Italy by Piedmont, with significant French help.
Sure.
That being said, when you look at when Cavour was in charge, Italy had problems, but Italy lurched from success to success. I mean, they kept snatching victory from the jaws of defeat because of his crazy gambles that paid off. He's a workaholic. He hated delegating. He surrounded himself with yes men, prime minister and minister of finance and minister of foreign affairs and minister of justice. I mean, excuse me.
Wow.
So things were falling apart because there weren't enough people. But at the same time, he was a genius. And perhaps the best argument for him being a great man of history is that when he died, it wasn't until Mussolini that Italy found somebody who was as capable. I don't want to cast Mussolini in a positive light.
Yeah.
But you do want to respect that the man was maybe formidable is the word I want. Mussolini was a formidable human being. Not a good one, but formidable. And so was Cavour. And it was a good, 60 years between the two of them, between the two of their you know, peaks.
Sure. Yeah. That's very interesting, yeah. And, of course, the great man of history idea, it runs rampant in the 20th century, let alone the 19th.
Yes.
So your podcast, which obviously I should have plugged at the start because that's the way these things normally run. I think it's because it's the last one. We're kind of the last collaboration episode. I've kind of the wheels have come off at this stage. But I'd like to think that with with your examination of Italian history, your very in-depth examination, by the way, and the depth that you go into, and the evident research that you put into the podcast, and this isn't just me kissing up because you're on the podcast. I mean, you know that I think it's not only a really well done podcast, but it's a very important story that you are telling, because it's almost like the counter story to the German one, in that it's like a series of missed opportunities and big disappointments. And that sounds terrible. I don't want to make it sound like it's a tragic story that you tell in your podcast, but
may I say it's a tragic epilogue?
Yes, yeah. Like, to me, the Italian unification is, in a way, a sad story. But I think that the first Italo-Ethiopian War really does epitomize, like, it encapsulates that, because it's Italy's most notable foray into kind of, with the exception of their annexation in Libya that would come like 10 years later or so. But this act here, it was really their big foray, and it failed epically. And I think that really, it says a lot about the experience.
I'm working this weekend, in fact, on my next episode, episode 49, titled To Be Determined, which will be released presumably before your episode goes out. As slow as I am these days. I hope I'll get it out. It's been a while. So I'm wrapping up the Italian unification. We're in the 1860s, we're at the very end of the series, and we're coming to the big so what questions. And that ties into what you just said, which is, you look at Italy, you look at history, you say, well, it had Rome, it had the Renaissance and the papacy, it was this big deal, and then it was fragmented for a long time. Then it comes back together, and it looks like it's going to be, like it should be, another great power, you know, another France, another Germany, another Russia, another Britain. It kind of is. I mean, it's always one foot in the door. It's never quite a great power with a capital G, capital P, but it's always big enough that you have to pay attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
One of the books I was reading put it really well, for those listening to my series, Massimo D'Azeglio, famous Italian politician, was musing that the problem here was that the people behind Italian unification were trying to reclaim something. They were trying to recreate their past greatness. But Italy never really existed until 1870. The Romans were in Italy, but they didn't consider themselves Italian.
Sure.
The Renaissance was full of fragmentation. There was very little Italian identity. So the Italians were trying to recreate past greatness. They were trying to reclaim what they thought they had lost, rather than trying to make something new, to achieve new greatness. Mm. Case in point, the city of Rome. When Italy unified in 1860-61, they did not have Rome. The Pope still had that. They didn't get it till 1870. And they wanted it because, I mean, it's Rome.
Sure.
It's full of ancient mystique and power. I mean, Europeans love to love ancient Rome. It's a powerful symbol, and Massimo D'Azeglio argued in 1860s, a huge mistake, because you're buying into all the mythos, you're buying into all the symbols, and you're living in the shadow of it.
Right.
So the Italians kept saying they needed this baptism of blood. They needed something to tie them all together. So they kept looking for wars to win. They fought the Austrians. They fought in 1866 and lost. They were on the winning side, even though they lost their own battles. Italo-Ethiopian War, this is another case. Italy was financially, socially, linguistically, politically fractured. There were lots of problems, mass emigration. This is the period where millions of Italians come to the United States.
Yeah.
Because conditions in the South are so terrible. And this is another fun fact. The North conquered the South politically, and the South conquered the North gastronomically. Italian food, if you think Italian food and you're not from Italy, you're thinking of Southern Italian food. Pasta. Yeah. Pizza, that's Southern. Northern food is, especially, I'm generalizing, Northern food tends to be a little more German, a little more stews, more butter. So, and the reason why the U.S. has so much pizza and pasta is because we're full of Southern Italians.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
So the Italo-Ethiopian War was, well, you know what we need? We need a war. And you know what? It's going to be cheap, it's going to be quick, and it's going to be easy. The frustration of Italy with feeling that they haven't lived up to their promise.
Yes, that summarizes how I felt about it, yeah.
Yeah, it's the frustration of feeling that they should be more. And a lot of that stems from as I said, it's not a terrible idea to think of the unification as the conquest of Italy by Piedmont. That's not entirely fair, and I don't mean to be flippant about it, but just that's a useful perspective because it helps to explain why they kept, you know, 30 years later, or yeah, 30 years later, kept feeling that they needed a unifying event. They didn't come together willingly, really. They kind of, it's all kind of sort of stuff. Jammed together lightning quick, and they had a language, a bureaucratic system, a system of laws, and an army shoved down their throats and said, you're all Italians now, pay your taxes.
Yeah, yeah, sure. I get what you mean. Yeah, it doesn't sound like a recipe for success, all right? And it's certainly not the same story. I mean, it's unification, but it's on a different, like, a different model completely to the German case.
Yeah, Piedmont was often called the Prussia of Italy.
It was, yes. And if you want to go, if you want to take that further, during the period I was looking at, 1914, the Serbian Black Hand, they actually had their magazine or their pamphlet, if you like, was called Piedmont because of that. They thought that they would be Serbia would be the Prussia, if you like, of a new greater Slav state. Yeah, so that was...
That's an analogy that has been totally lost as history.
It's a fascinating one, though, isn't it?
The way it
evidently inspired other like, even people in the Black Hand who thought themselves... You couldn't say irredentist or the idea that they will be the founding state of a new superstate. It was really inspired by instances like these.
It's very interesting to compare the unification of these different places because, you know, there are Italians and there are Germans, but being an Italian means something different than being a German. And this isn't a better or worse thing. It's just different. And in surprising ways that I have friends of the family who are Italian, and we were visiting them, and they're telling us a story. They were up in the South Tyrol. This is an area that was part of Switzerland. Don't quote me on the exact place. It was northern Italy. I'm blanking on the name and the history of the place. And the dominant language there is German. Something like 80% of people have German as their first language. So one of the young children of my friend was up there at a ski resort, and she's saying, oh, look at all these Germans. These are all Italian citizens. I mean, yeah. You know, their grandparents were Italian citizens. And it's just, but oh, no, these are Germans. Yeah, or the disconnect between North and South.
It's still, correct me if I'm wrong, that's still an issue today, is it?
It's a very large issue that the two halves do not like each other.
I believe there's even political parties. I mean, was there a Northern League or something?
Yeah, the Lega Nord. Even though there isn't a strong movement for actual secession, you're very right to point out that there are political parties in Italy that are really unhappy about the way things are going with the North-South split.
Well, I suppose in a way it's an unnatural creation. I mean, you would think looking at it, yes, it's Italian subcontinent, like the country, it should be unified because that would make sense.
It looks right on the map.
Yeah, yeah, it looks tidy. Just like we like our history looking tidy, yeah, we like the map looking tidy, so... Get together, North and South, cooperate already.
but the two halves had dramatically different histories, because so that central and northern Italy is what had the Renaissance. That's your Venices, your Romes, your Tuscany, Florence, Milan, Genoa, Bologna. That's the area where you had all the little city-states fighting and feuding. So that's one kind of shared history up there. The South was ruled by actually Norman kings. You know, so the Normans invaded England. They also invaded Sicily and southern
Sicily.
Italy.
Yeah.
Yep. Sicily, the island, and southern Italy split for a while, for a couple hundred years. But nonetheless, other than that, like the southern half of Italy was a single unit, a monolithic block, the king with a royal court, very top down. So when the two get thrown together at high speed in 1860, it's a culture clash that almost nobody in the North predicted, because nobody in the North had been to the South.
Yeah, and correct me if I'm wrong as well, but was it people from the North that mostly wanted unification?
Yes. So this is something I'll talk about in my final wrap-up episode. Figuring out, nailing down who wanted what is tricky, but Southerners, especially the mass of Southern peasants, didn't care. The joke that's often told, I don't know if it's really true, but a foreign observer from France or England was in Naples during the unification, and they heard people shouting "L'Italia, L'Italia," and then they would turn to him and say, "So wait, what does L'Italia mean?" That's the name of the king's wife, right? her name is Talia, L'Italia, right? That they wanted free. They wanted an end to crippling taxation. They had local scores to settle. The mafia. Though I don't know if it existed by that name quite yet, but the idea of the mafia of strong men wielding local power was already a big deal. People had local scores to settle. They weren't interested in some grand unification. That was much more a northern idea, often well-intentioned. People thinking, you know, this will make a better Italy. It'll be a resurgence of manhood and virility. You know, this baptism of blood will become a great nation and people will have to respect us.
Yeah, yeah.
They spent a lot less time thinking about, well, so they speak what is effectively a different language. It's a dialect of Italian different enough that they're mutually unintelligible.
Wow.
They don't speak the same language. They have a vastly different legal tradition, and in fact, a somewhat more modern legal tradition, because when the French invaded the South, they brought the Napoleonic Code and updated the South's laws. They have different economy. They have a very protectionist economy. So when the North, which is all about free trade, came in and lowered all the barriers, Southern industry, which was admittedly still a small scale, just collapsed.
Oh, yeah.
But so I have heard your original episode on the Italo-Ethiopian War. I have not heard your updated one. Could you tell me a little bit more about what's changed between the two?
Well, I think really when I did it the first time around, the common theme of Bismarck running through the episodes, I mean, it was just a bit ridiculous that I talked.
Oh, yes. Your gigantic man crush on Bismarck.
Yeah, I mean, he's on a t-shirt now, Benjamin. It's like When Diplomacy Fails, his t-shirts has... It says, always be yourself, unless you can be Bismarck, then always be Bismarck. And I think that's some words to live by, really.
That's good.
Yeah, yeah. I was very happy with Rob over at History Tease sorted me out with that. So yeah, check out When Diplomacy Fails' t-shirts. That's a handy plug right there, yeah.
It's hilarious.
Yeah, it was an inspired idea, really. It's a testament to how much he kind of was the chancellor of the early stages of the podcast, really. He was kind of in the background, and I think that's because I found him so inherently fascinating, but it wasn't a very good excuse to kind of bring him in when I should have been talking about the actual war in the episode. And I think it always, that war, the episode 19 always stood out to me as one of those ones I'd like to redo again. Structure, not just for the sake of the audio glitches that went on in it, but also structure-wise, I didn't feel like it was very well done. And that was because, really, it was a rush job, and it was Christmas Eve, and I just wanted to be done with the whole thing, which is never a good way to go around. Right. But yeah, more to the point of your question, the way it's done now, I like to think that it focuses more on the issues at hand. It actually looks at the impact that this war had on the Italian psyche. And actually, as well, I didn't make this point in that episode, but the later Italian actions, such as the invasion of Libya in September 1911, this is kind of seen not as the first domino. I don't want to make, because I just hate the idea of the First World War being inevitable, but the...
A contributing factor?
Sure. Yeah, I would say contributing factor. Yeah, just because the fact once the invasion of Libya happens, basically then the Balkan states get all up in arms and they all decide, oh yeah, we're gonna invade the Baltic states because Balkan, not Baltic, Jamie Mac. we're gonna invade the Balkan states because the Ottomans are like depressed and demoralized after losing Libya, and then when they all get emboldened after those Balkan wars, which only end in like June of 1913, that's when like Austria-Hungary is like, oh, what's going on here? The Serbia is way bigger now than it used to be. And then the assassination of the Archduke happens. So it's like this self-fulfilling prophecy of we were right to be worried all along. So I don't want to try and argue that all those events were inherently connected, but certainly the fact that Italy failed in Ethiopia made it feel like it had to have a consolation prize. And in that consolation prize that they chose Libya, pretty much.
Italy was constantly seeking to prove itself on the world stage, which kind of helps to explain in some ways why fascism was so attractive. Because this is pre-World War II. World War II has not happened yet. You don't know about all the horrors of fascism and what it led to. You know, it's 1930, and you're looking around and going, wow, so all these weak the puny democratic states are having these massive issues, the Great Depression. You know, there's, France is tearing itself apart. The U.S. is ignoring everybody. You know, Spain is a god-awful mess.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And fascism looks kind of attractive. Strong leader, someone who's going to come in and sort this mess out and give us the respect we've been hurting for at that point, what it would have been 60 years, 70 years.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
So it's not hard to see why somebody would have looked to a Mussolini, because fascism was brand new. At one point early in his rise, Hitler wrote to Mussolini, you know, a fan letter saying, hey, you know, I love you. I love your work. Could you send me a signed photo? in redoing the episode.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Was there anything that surprised you that you hadn't learned the first time around?
When I did it the first time, I don't think in my head I realized how big a deal it was. Now, this kind of gets into sensitive issues of racism, all kind of thing, but we might as well just jump right into it. The idea that...
We're all aware that Europeans of this era were racist in a... were prejudiced in a way that's hard to understand today. For all the problems we have, they were proud of their prejudices. They did not see their problems... as problems. They said, you know, this is scientific fact. This is the way it is. We, in fact, are just better.
Yeah, yeah. And, like, it's proven because of our historical experience. Look how powerful Europe is, therefore.
And because the cubic capacity of our skull is greater.
Oh, my goodness, yeah, I know.
or because our frontal lobes are larger, and that's clearly the seat of reason. Or even because our diet is... morally superior because potatoes are somehow better than rice. but it's kind of shortcomings of halfway done science. You look at stuff and you say, well, it's self-evident. We're better. Now let's explain why we're better.
Mm.
The proof's in the pudding. We're in charge. Therefore, we're better.
Yeah, yeah. And you jumped into that handily for me so I don't have to run through it, because it always makes me cringe out of my skin. I mean, I was talking about this even in relation to the racism towards Asia in general. I was talking about this with Mark Painter from the History of the 20th Century podcast, collaboration episode on the Russo-Japanese War. And he made the point that bigotry was just so rampant. It wasn't abnormal, it was normal. And that always fascinated me, people thinking and being geared towards just seeing people as inherently inferior. When Italy got such a bloody nose from the war, I think I found that really, like, I was satisfied on behalf of the Ethiopians because they were proving Italy wrong.
Funny feeling, but I know what you mean. Take that, you bigots.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, like, the thing I found most hilarious was that in order to justify Italy losing, you had suddenly all these scientists were kind of like, oh, well, as you can see, the Ethiopians are actually a race of the white man who moved into Ethiopia and founded the first Abyssinian Empire, and the descendants of Ethiopians are merely tanned white men with these same capabilities.
Yeah, yeah. So, don't worry, it's okay, it doesn't count. because they're actually white. Yeah, it's kind of hard to relate to.
I know.
I mean, it's kind of like a first world, third world division, but explicitly racial.
Sure.
That you know, if a big country gets beaten by a small country, that's embarrassing because of the socioeconomic differences, not because their skin color is different.
Yes.
So one thing I've mentioned a couple times in my podcast is there was a saying in Italy. So, for example, let's say you were from Milan. You'd say, Africa begins at Tuscany. I mean, if you're in Tuscany, Africa begins at Rome. If you're in Rome, Africa begins at Naples. In a strange way, there's more truth to that in a non-offensive way, simply because southern Italy was much more tied into Arab invasions and Arab trade routes and North African peoples,
just sure.
historically, economically, genetically. But they were making a value judgment about it. They were saying that basically, you know, civilization ends here.
Yeah,
Well, so one reason why this particular incident may have hurt the Italians more than it would have hurt anybody else is because for hundreds of years, there'd been this insult tossed around that Italians can't fight. I mean, and this is something that by the mid-1800s was making every Italian twitch.
Uh-huh.
It was, they had this built-in inferiority complex because the rest of Europe, well, you know, oh, Italians, oh, this hot blood and Latin type kind of thing.
Mm.
Oh, you know, they're good with art and they're good with music, you know, but they're so hot-headed and you know, they love women and pleasure and wine. They don't work and they can't fight. And they can't fight. And which, in a very superficial sense, if you look at their history, it seems to bear that out. But if you look at all deeper, that's not really true. If you look at, say, Giuseppe Garibaldi and his volunteers in various wars in the 1800s, the Italians could fight very well if they could defeat larger forces, very well disciplined. In fact, the southern Italian army, parts of it were very well trained. The issue is that Italy, time and again, had hysterically bad leadership. Just awful. I mean, so it's Piedmont, the Kingdom of Piedmont, northwest Italy. Their dream for 200 years had been to take Lombardy, the north central Italy, area around Milan. Mm. They've been dreaming to take it for hundreds of years.
Hmm.
And in the 1800s, they had a couple chances. And you know what they never got? Maps. They never bothered to get maps of the country next door. They were always short on boots and belt buckles and guns. And the top-level leadership was almost always just terrible. So you end up with it looking like Italians can't fight, simply because for mostly institutional reasons,
sure,
the leadership refused to learn.
Does that change? Did that change much after that period?
Short answer: no. I mean, look at the Italo-Ethiopian War. War One's not fair because everybody had outdated leadership. World War II, you have the same kind of thing. So in North Africa, some of the Italian units were considered as good as the German units were fighting alongside them. There are plenty of good Italian soldiers. And so, you know, the Mussolini ordered Greece invaded in the middle of the harvest season. So
yeah,
half the Italian army was at home. So you have things like that. As for the very modern era, I don't know. And on some level, it might date back to that I was talking about when we opened this, about Italy trying to reclaim something rather than make something new, the Italians of certain eras, let me rephrase, the Italian leaders of certain eras have kind of felt like the world is ours for the taking. All we need to do is reach out and take it, because everybody else is. The Ethiopian War, the Libyan War, World War One, World War Two, and even the stuff during my podcast, that we, you know, all those stupid Austrians, we can take them, and they can't, because they don't invest in the upper level, the training. They don't invest in the organization. And the funny thing is that Piedmont was supposed to be the Prussia of Italy, the place with a long military tradition, whereas the rest of Italy, for the most part, had no military tradition whatsoever at that point, because during the Renaissance, they mostly hired mercenaries, and that was a couple hundred years before that. And since then, they've been dominated by foreign powers, so they didn't need armies. It's very easy to chalk it up to, it's just those disorganized southern Italians, those Mediterranean people, they can't do anything. That's an old hat. That's very easy to say and very, very shallow.
Mm.
The fighting quality of the people is probably identical. It's the specific historical events that have led leadership to make bad decisions.
I see. Yeah, yeah. The unfortunate thing for Italy was that there was a plethora of bad decisions, really.
Yeah, yeah. When they lose to the Ethiopians, the old, you know, the, in the back of their heads, they can all hear Italians can't fight. And so it makes them even madder than it would have made, I don't know, France or England or Germany feel, probably, because they weren't so sensitive.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Italians, I feel like they had something to prove, especially with the Scramble for Africa ongoing.
Yeah, perfect way to put it. They had something to prove, or at least they felt they had something to prove.
Yeah, yeah.
And that led them to time and again make mistakes because they wanted to prove it so badly they were willing to ignore everything else. It just seemed right. We're Italians, right? We're the heirs to the Romans, we're the heirs to the great states of the Renaissance. You know, we need this.
Yeah. Oh, big time. And I think they're the kind of eagerness to get what they needed didn't really. It didn't translate itself into doing the research beforehand and seeing that Ethiopia is actually not a very easy country to march over, and they can field an army of about 100,000, but they are supplied by Russian firearms, and they are supplied with British money, and they have got like French relationships. And I mean, on the one hand, I don't want to make the Italians seem like they were right by trying to argue after they lost that, oh, the Ethiopians, they're actually white men, but as far as African states went at that point, the Ethiopians had gone some way towards adopting Western practices, even in the use of firearms came from like Western companies, essentially. I don't know exactly which firearms they would have used, but certainly their practices were not like... You wouldn't look at the way that they operated their state and think to yourself, oh yeah, like what a backward way. I mean, given them another 20 years, they would have been modeled essentially like a kind of Europe in Africa almost.
Exactly. It puts the lie to the idea that this is a genetic difference. No, this is a cultural, historical, economic, and political difference. The Ethiopians were adapting and modernizing, and that's what it comes down to, modernization. It's the same thing with Japan in 1904, is it? The Russo-Japanese War?
Yeah.
Versus, oh my God, how did white people lose to Asians? This is insane. We cannot handle this. You know, oh my stars, take the fainting couch. And it's the same thing. It's just, well, what do you expect? People are modernizing. They've looked at what you've done. They've taken the parts they liked and left the parts they didn't like. They have modern weapons and modern training. What did you expect?
Clearly
something different. It's a wake-up call.
If you were to say, put your finger on maybe a result or something that we said that the Italians felt they had something to prove, or like they thought they did at least. Do you think they learned anything from this experience?
So I'll say that 20th century Italian history is not my my strong suit. I specialize in 1790 to 1870.
Right.
I really don't know. I think that World War I would have been the transformative event. We all know about Western Front in World War I.
Sure.
Not 90% of us know about the Eastern Front in World War I. 80% know about the Lawrence of Arabia Front of World War I. The Italian Front is little known because very little happened. Very little changed. They had, I forget, there was some valley or gorge or chasm or something the Austrians and Italians fought over for 3 years. And I can't remember the name of the place, but by 1918, they were on to the 15th battle of the whatever. And apparently, you know, they apparently still find frozen bodies and artillery in the thaws in the mountains they were fighting in. So presumably people learned some lessons from that. But I can tell you a little bit about the politics of it.
Sure.
So Italy had a complicated way of doing business politically. So they had a Westminster-style parliament, more or less. I mean, they had a lower house and an upper house and a king. When Cavour was in charge, so he was in charge from 1852, I think, to 1861 when he died. He was the giant. Everybody else was small next to him. He was the smartest man in the room. He knew more about politics than anybody else on the peninsula. Now, as time went on, other people got was catching up some, but he was still the best politician because he'd been studying this stuff as a hobby since he was a young man.
Sure.
So he was the most important person, and political parties didn't really emerge in a strong way. There were left-leaning people and right-leaning people, but they didn't have modern political parties, which you might go, well, fantastic, that's great, right? Political parties suck, or they're the enemy of progress. Well, they definitely have their downsides, but they make governing possible. Let's say you want to pass a bill. You want to, I don't know, a hot-button item then was divorce. Should divorce be not only legal, but should it be controlled by the state, not the church? Okay, so this is a big hot-button issue, and you take it into Parliament, and without parties, you really don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
You don't want to present bills that you don't think are going to pass. When you bring a bill to a vote, you should have an idea of whether it's going to win or not, or pass or not.
Yeah.
And so the problem was that because there were no strong parties, every time you needed something done, you needed to glad hand your way around everybody, make horse trades with every individual member of Parliament from every little region. Oh, you need some money, you need a favor, you need a cousin in the job, fine. And so, and Cavour was this giant who could control it all, so he made it work. After him, they fell into a political system called transformismo. And what that basically is, whenever there was a crisis, the prime minister would be forced to resign, and a new coalition would be formed.
Mm-hmm.
But the coalition was basically the same coalition every time. It would just shift a little to the left or a little to the right. It was a centrist government. There was one major political party in the center and then fringe parties,
right?
Which is a real problem because it means you have no alternatives. So the same people keep – the same crowd keeps being in charge. Yes, it did flip back and forth, and eventually they did kind of have two parties, but it was still the same crowd over and over and over again. One of the problems you see, and why this relates to your question, is they never got they very rarely got fresh blood. It was always the same crowd. So Francesco Crispi, who was the prime minister during the Ethiopian War, I think, he'd been around forever. Off and on, off and on. It's a quirk of the history of the politics of the place.
Yeah.
So, and what that leads to are the refusal to learn, the feeling that you need to prove something, because you don't get meaningful change at the top, so there's no push for changes below.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. An interesting case can be made for the impact that that fractured system had on, well, I suppose it is fractured in one sense, but on the other, it just kind of never changes. It's all together. Yeah, unhealthy. Yeah. The big impact that had on Italy's performance internationally, because like you said, the state that it was in, it almost compelled them to act in a way that they thought would shore up their popularity and maybe make citizens feel like they were getting a good deal when they really weren't getting a good deal at all.
Yeah, it was not a very responsive government. It got very corrupt.
Oh, right. Wow. It doesn't paint, we talked about this before, but it doesn't paint a very optimistic picture. Do you think that Italian history, I know you said your forte isn't so much the 20th century, but do you think we should see Italian history as a tragedy, or do you think we should see it as a...
So one thing, it's an excellent question. One thing I always try to remember when doing my podcast is this isn't my history. My wife is Italian distantly. I'm not really Italian at all. This isn't my history. I'm telling, on some level, I mean, it's all of our story. It's a shared human story. But in another sense, it's not quite my story. So I don't try and sugarcoat anything. But at the same time, I have to be respectful. And it's not hard. I mean, bending over backwards. But it's just a matter of, I'm never trying to make fun of anybody. Except maybe King Victor Emmanuel II. I don't have a high opinion of him. But other than that, I mean, this is a real story of real people. And a question of what does it mean to be Italian is a complicated question I can't answer. Is Italian history a tragedy? I would say that on a high political level, on a great man of history level, that there are themes and traps Italy seems to keep falling into.
Sure.
To be honest, a lot of this was because even through the 20th century, Italy was not always a master of its own fate. It was kind of the little brother great power. I mean, it was a, unlike, say, Spain, which was almost not a great power at all by the late 1800s, Italy was big enough you couldn't ignore it. It was important enough economically, militarily, financially. You had to pay attention to it, but it just never had the same clout that Germany or France did.
Yeah.
So a lot of what happened in Italian history was determined elsewhere. Other people, for hundreds of years before and even after, Italy was carved up to suit the needs of the great power victors. Rather than a tragedy, I would say that I'm specifically not talking about modern Italian history because I simply don't know much about it. I know the outline, but not much more than that. But between 1850 and 1950, the story of Italy is the failure to achieve what everybody felt in their heart should have been achievable, but which when you look back with the benefit of hindsight and more modern understanding of economics, might not have been there at all. Italy was a linguistically, politically, historically fractured place, and the expectation that they would just merge together magically and form this, you know, strong, virile, strapping Italian man was unrealistic. And so there's a sense of disillusionment because it failed to live up to these incredibly unrealistic dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have the Italian diaspora, people leaving because they're starving, coming to America or South America. So it's a story of struggle. It's a story of trying to achieve trying to live up to the promise. Because on paper, as I said, it looks like they should be a great power, full stop. I mean, you know, they're like France or Germany.
Yeah.
But there's more to it than that. And I think a lot of damage was done early on. Understandably, I mean, I don't think there was maybe a right choice. The country was unified and immediately started fracturing. And so the government said, well, we need to keep it together. Quick, get some glue and start and mold, stick it all together and forcing everything to be the same. One language, one set of laws, one set of economic policies. And this did a lot of damage, particularly in the South, because it one size did not fit all in this country. Actually, before I'll stop rambling in a moment, but very tempting if you only look at this in a cursory manner to make a value judgment. Oh, those Italians, you know, why don't they feel more Italian? Why don't they have more national pride? It's a silly argument. By analogy, the European Union. Okay, I mean, in the future, we might look back on it and say, well, oh, you know, you foolish Germans, why didn't you have more EU spirit? I picked Germany at random just because they're big. That's not a subtle hint about anything. You know, or you're part of the European Union. Would you say that you were Irish first or European Unionist first?
Oh, jeepers, Irish. I mean, there's no question about that. I mean, maybe some French or Germans might want us to think that we have European values, which to an extent is arguably true, but you couldn't take, you can put the Ireland in the European Union, but you can't make European Union citizens out of Irish citizens, if that makes sense. Probably doesn't.
And so if you take that, your response, and replace EU with Italy and Ireland with, say, Florence or Milan, it's that. Who the heck are we to judge people for not feeling more Italian? This person was raised once again, I'm not speaking about modern Italian. I'm thinking more 1800s.
Sure.
Person was raised in Milan in Lombardy. They have their own local dialect, their own history, their own saints, and so on. And who are we to judge them for not feeling like something else? It's just like asking someone from Ireland to have their primary identity be a European.
Yeah.
It's important, but that's not how it works.
No, not at all.
At least not quickly. Whereas in the United States, you know, in our early history, you know, George Washington was a Virginian, practically first. I mean, the state was, in many cases, more important than the national identity. Now, after a Civil War and lots of time, that's faded. And the joke is Texas is supposed to be different, but there is still a little bit of that, but it's nothing like it used to be. I mean, I'm an American first and a Marylander second. You know, and Maryland as a far second. I mean, I love Maryland, fantastic place to live, but that's because it's a great place to live, not because I have any particular stirring at the sight of the Maryland flag. I mean, it's not a...
Yeah, you're not a Maryland nationalist or anything like that.
Exactly. So hopefully that can help explain some of the question of identity, at least as I've been able to suss it out.
Sure.
That it's not a matter of disloyalty. It's a matter of who are you deep down? And you can't just come in and tell somebody, you're Italian now, feel Italian.
And
that's kind of what people tried to do, and it never really worked. So they kept looking for that baptism of blood that would do it, and that never really worked. So it's a complex question.
Yeah, I think it is. And I think, I think it's worsened by the fact that the German case that keeps popping up happened virtually parallel to it. And the
yes.
German case was a success. And I think, understanding history is realizing that just because it's unification doesn't mean it's unification. I mean,
right.
In a sense, the German and Italian cases, it sounds obvious that they would be apples and oranges because they are two different peoples, two different countries, et cetera, but when people look at them, they're like, well, why did the German case, it's not even a case of why did the German case work? It's why did the Italian case fail almost? It's it's all the Italians' fault. They should have been more Italian. But then you look at it and it's
it's a totally natural reaction.
Yeah.
Very high-handed. Why couldn't you have been more Italian? Because he's not Italian. He's not more Italian because, Italy doesn't mean anything to him.
Mm. He
was one day someone with a gun showed up and said, you're Italian, speak the way we speak or else. I'm trying to remember, an actor, famous actor from Venice, can't remember his name. I think he's contemporary. I think he's older, but he once said that, Italian, our first foreign language. At home, he spoke the Venetian dialect, which is somewhat mutually intelligible. It's not a totally different language, but it's not the same language. You do need to learn the other one in a class.
Well, that's it's a very interesting way to talk. And I think before we kind of wrap it up, we've actually already asked the kind of traditional wrap-up questions I like to ask about the whole kind of, could you give us your passing thought on it? But I think that, Cole, the whole kind of look into even how history has played out since then and how Italy very much today, with the likes of the Nord League, the Northern League, the Liga Nord kind of thing, it very much has inherited its history from the period of history that you're looking at now.
It's frustrating. So, how you said you don't like when people say the domino World War One. I also don't like to do it myself sometimes when you say, this is where the modern world began. The Concert of Europe, the Congress of Vienna, 1815, that created the modern Europe. Well, you can pick any major event. You can say, "Oh yes, this laid the fault lines for World War One." You can see World War One from this.
Mm.
It would be oversimplifying to say, "Well, oh yes, modern Italy can totally be explained." Listen to my podcast; you will understand modern Italian history. But at the same time, if you don't know that period, you're gonna have a very hard time because, simply it's how Italy went from being about 11 countries to one country, And the details, the devil in the details of how that happened is going to be repeated for the next 100 years. All the little mistakes that were made up front are going to be magnified in their history.
I think that gives us a good rounding off comment there. I want to thank you very much for coming on, Benjamin Ashwell, and I want to just give you a chance to properly plug yourself now. Where can listeners go if they want to find the Italian Unification Podcast?
So you can find us online at talkinghistorypodcast.com or on iTunes. Just search Talking History Italian Unification. Anybody who's interested can find it. Let me know what you think. It's a project I really enjoyed doing. And what fun fact you guys may not know, Zach here helped preview my early script and recording. I went to him for help when I was starting to podcast. He was an inspiration for me to do it. So, as I'm getting close to ending the Italian Unification series, this is a good chance to say thank you for your support. It really did help to have somebody on the inside tell you, this is a good microphone, don't let that. Oh, and when you do iTunes, make sure to do it like this. So thank you very much for your help.
Oh, it was my pleasure. I like to think that podcasters can pay for it. Like I said, you had a great story to tell. You told it very well. And David Crowther in the History of England really helped me out. He gave me my first introduction to the world of podcasting through
the Bannockburn, right?
Yes, Bannockburn. Yeah, yeah. As he said, I was helping him out because it saved him having to tell the story of when the English got walloped by the Scots. I thought it was a brilliant way to put it. But
he's a very funny guy.
Yes, he is. Oh, very, very fond of David. He's done a lot for When Diplomacy Fails, but humbled and flattered really that you would accredit that to me. Don't let it take away from the fact that you do have a very good product yourself, and you've done a very good job yourself in bringing it across to a wide audience.
Well, thank you very much. That's very kind of you. I'm expecting a call on your 10-year anniversary, and we can do this again in 3D VR.
Yes, yeah, that's the dream. I'll be doing 10 weeks to Run Wild
Because surely the future's going to kick in between now and then.
Well, one would think so, but who knows what the future holds? Who knows what the future holds for When Diplomacy Fails or Benjamin Ashwell?
Thanks very much for coming on.
Thank you for having me, and I look forward to hearing this episode hearing the remastered Italo-Ethiopian episode when it comes out.
Cool. Cheers.
Alrighty, what did we think of that? So, Benjamin Ashwell and I talked over a whole load of topics, a whole load of subjects, Italian topics. I hope you enjoyed this extended look at the Italo-Ethiopian War, and I genuinely hope it makes up for the travesty that was the original version of this episode. Just doing what I can, guys, trying to erase the memory of that travesty one remastered episode at a time. So I hope it succeeded. Let me know through the usual channels. I'm going to take my leave now. I know it's been nearly an hour, so if you guys have stuck with it all the way through, I'm glad. I'm not really sure how these kind of reach you, if you're happy to listen to them or not. I've gotten mostly good feedback. Some of people just basically say that they miss Sean, but he would abandon me and go to the Netherlands, and not much I can do about that. So yeah, thanks very much for listening, guys. I really appreciate it. Thanks for spreading the word and being fit and patronizing me as always. WDFpodcast.com. You're amazing. I know. Don't roll your eyes at me. Okay. It's time to go. Thanks very much for listening, guys. And I just might be seeing you all again very soon.